content. I was asked to present some responses from my last visit before the committee a couple of weeks ago. So one question that I was asked that I deferred was about, there were several questions about the state of Minnesota, which I used as an example. So Senator Keel asked about the percentage of Minnesota's budget reserve compared to its budget. So just to refresh everybody's memory, Alaska does not have a formal target for our budget reserve, the constitutional budget reserve or statutory budget reserve. Many states do, either as a percentage of their budget or as just a fixed dollar amount. Minnesota is unusual in that it has a calculation based on projected volatility. Alaska has probably the most volatile revenue in the country. So we're a little unusual in that a percentage of budget that applies to other states may not work. So we looked at that Minnesota method and applied it to Alaska. So for comparison, Minnesota, when they calculated their amount, recommended a reserve level of 4.8% of their biennial budget. They have a two-year budget there, which is about 9.6% of their annual budget. By comparison, the $2 billion recommendation that OMB sent would be 27% of our annual budget, and LFD's estimate of $3 billion would be about 40%. So, you know, given the higher level of volatility, I think any recommendation that is made for Alaska will just be much higher than in other states. Senator Bishop also asked about Minnesota's current budget status, and as of December, their management and budget office estimated that they would have a surplus of $17.6 billion for the biennium. That includes leftover amounts from the previous biennium that were carried over because it's beyond their reserve balance. Any other questions on that slide? Okay, another question from Senator Keel here on page 4. Senator Keel asked about the amount of new school debt assumed in legislative finances model. Again, to recap for the committee, back in 2021, the Legislative Finance Division, at the request of the Fiscal Policy Working Group, I always get that wrong, adopted into our model an assumption that once the school debt moratorium ends in 2025, there will be some new school debt that comes on. Basically, just a placeholder to provide a difference between if you extended that moratorium indefinitely and allowed it to expire. So our assumption is that the state share of new debt would be $7.8 million a year, so $7.8 million added on each year to the debt amount that is otherwise declining. So it starts to spike upwards a little bit. And that figure was derived by taking a 10-year average of the state share of new debt before the moratorium began in 2015 and prorated it down for the lower reimbursement rates when the moratorium ends. Previous to the moratorium, the reimbursement rates were either 60 or 70%, depending on the qualifications of the project. When the moratorium lifts, the reimbursement rates will be either 40 or 50%, so a bit lower. And the actual amount of new school debt is, you know, a very difficult number to estimate. The current interest rates will have a strong influence. The actual utilization of the program, some municipalities have been a little hesitant to commit to trying to go for this program, given that the state has not consistently funded it. And on the other hand, there may be a buildup of school projects that would, you know, encourage larger usage. The other factor that we don't even address on the slide is that even once the moratorium ends, if projects are authorized, the bonds aren't actually taken out and repaid until the money is needed to do the project. So if there's a multi-year window to construct a school or reconstruct a school, you may see that debt authorized in 2025, but not actually be issued until 2026 or 2027, and then not repaid until after that. So you may see a slower ramp up than what we show in our model. Again, it's a very rough estimate, but we thought that it's better than nothing to at least use that historical number. Going on to slide 5. So this is a question from Senator Sedman. we presented a slide that compared the capital budget over the past 20 years or so, a little less, 16 years, to the oil prices that year. Senator Stedman asked us to change that comparison to the state gross domestic product for a different relationship. You can see that there is still a relationship. Part of that is due to that same price of oil that drives our domestic product and then also drives our revenue availability. But that's just not nearly as volatile as oil prices that were jumping all over the page.
So as I recall, the reason I asked this question is there's a concern that we've had stagnant GDP growth for several years, and we're being surpassed substantially by comparative states in the Northwest, Pacific Northwest. So that just leads to the obvious question of the policies that we've been implementing, and are they the most effective in trying to push our GDP forward? And I think that is certainly questionable at best. So we probably will explore that in a little more detail later on. But the stagnant economy in Alaska doesn't help us keep our family, young families here. And we see it in our drop of our school enrollment, amongst other areas. Out-migration of population is something we need to also consider when we're dealing with our budget numerics.
Going on to slide six. So again, this was a request from Senator Stedman. Senator Stedman requested sensitivity showing the likelihood of various constitutional budget reserve balances in a single fiscal year. So our presentation included modeling based on the Senate Finance Committee's budget assumptions, which were the governor's budget at the time. This was the pre-amended budget with a $400 million capital budget instead of the governor's $276 million at the time. And then with three different PFD scenarios, the statutory PFD, 50% of the percent of market value, and then 25% of percent of market value. And in our probabilistic model, we showed just two CBR balances and the likelihood that we met them. We showed $500 million and $2 billion. Senator Stedman asked to see more CBR balances to see, you know, what the larger range is. So this table shows that for a single year. So this, we just took FY28 since that's, the fifth year from now. And so these numbers at 500 million and then 2 billion correspond to the numbers you saw in those slides before, but then we added in these other figures so you can see the likelihood of different CBR balances in there as well. And one thing I would note is I sent, I think last week, responses to committee questions that had an error in this table. This is the corrected version, and I will update that response to the committee as well with the corrected table.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Chairman, now we're getting into the new content. So this is an updated short fiscal summary with the governor's amended budget. I think the Office of Management and Budget showed you a version of their fiscal summary yesterday. Ours differs from them in a few respects, which I may point out, and also I'll talk about the bigger picture. So I'll go through the fiscal summary and then first talk about the FY23 situation and then transition to FY24. So on the revenue side, there's I'll just point to one item here is this adjustment for UGF revenue in FY24. One of the governor's is a negative $13.9 million adjustments. One of the governor's amendments was to the ADA dividend, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority dividend, to allow $13.9 million of ADA's dividend to be conveyed in the form of property rather than in cash. And so that's transferring the Mustang Road to the state of Alaska as a portion of the dividend. Since that's not cash like the previous dividend, that reduces our available UGF revenue. And so that's new language proposed by the governor that would have that effect on revenue, of reducing revenue by $13.9 million. Then going down to line 9 for supplemental appropriations. So unrestricted general fund supplemental appropriations for the operating budget, the governor has now proposed $98.5 million. I think on the slide that the governor present or that OMB presented, they had a slightly higher figure. We're counting things a little bit differently. They have a reappropriation of lapsing operating funds to the capital budget. We count that as a negative to the operating budget and a positive to the capital budget to reflect the movement of funds from one to the other. And so we show a lower operating supplemental number and a higher capital supplemental number than they do, but it nets out the same. So just if you're looking at the fiscal summary and say, hey, these don't quite match, that would be the reason. That's about $5 million. So the capital budget, there's $15.8 million of supplementals. That leads to a pre-transfer deficit in FY23 of $536.8 million. The pre-transfer deficit is essentially our fiscal deficit. It's based on our ongoing spending and revenue, where would our state be before we start transferring from savings accounts? To meet that deficit, we have a transfer of $350.3 million from the statutory budget reserve that was authorized last session to pay for two appropriations in the capital budget. So it's essentially just designated to those particular items and has the effect of reducing the deficit. And then $186.6 million of using the American Rescue Plan Act, that's federal funds, that can be used for revenue replacement. Since that's not an ongoing source of revenue, we show it as a fund transfer rather than as revenue because we kind of want to see the fiscal situation stay before that. In our previous fiscal summaries, there was an amount for K-12 forward funding. That has now been zeroed out. That amount for K-12 forward funding was based on available revenue after all other appropriations. Based on the governor's amended budget, that amount would be zero. There's no available revenue after supplementals. So instead, we have a post-transfer deficit of $200,000, roughly a balanced budget. That $200,000 would come from the statutory budget reserve, which is our designated, our first line of budget fillers. And we'll talk more about that FY23 situation in the following slide. But essentially, the highlight here is that K-12 forward funding number is now zero. Going to FY24, the agency operations number is up a little bit. That's as a result of the governor's amendments. Statewide items are down slightly as a result of the amendments due to a refinancing of some debt service. The capital budget was $276 million. Now it's $303 million after amendments. Dividend is unchanged, although we'll talk about that. That leads to a pre-transfer deficit of $434 million. The governor has, again, using the last bit of American Rescue Plan Act funds as a transfer. There's now a larger fund transfer on the other side, with depositing $7.5 million into the Renewable Energy Fund. That leads to a post-transfer deficit of $431 million that would come from the SBR and CBR in the governor's budget. So you may recall our last fiscal summary, the pre-transfer deficit had been $322 million. Now it's up by about $112 million. And there's no longer the K-12 forward funding as one of the deficit fillers. So that leaves more of the deficit to come out of our savings accounts, in this case, zeroing out the CBR and leaving and the rest from the Constitutional Budget Reserve.
So you want to, before we go into questions, you want to explain this reserve balance?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So we have three funds that we show as reserves, although only two of them are true budget reserves. So the top here is the statutory budget reserve. That is our SBR. That is available with a majority access by the legislature. The balance heading into FY23 was just about $20 million. The next is the constitutional budget reserve. That fund requires a three-quarters majority to access. The legislature does not currently have access, or the budget does not have CBR access in FY23, meaning that those funds are not available to fill any FY23 deficit without a further vote of the legislature. The balance is currently about $2.3 billion, although we're still waiting on those post-audit numbers that'll firm that up. In FY23, because there are no appropriations out, we project that will go up a little bit as a result of new income and then investment earnings. And then the deficit draw in FY24 would drop it back to about $2.1 billion. The last one is not a true budget reserve because it's also a source of revenue. That's the earnings reserve account. This is the realized balance only, obviously the spendable amount of the earnings reserve. And this balance assumes the statutory net income for FY23 matches the forecasts. And we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, and we'll cover it again, that currently that may not be quite hitting the forecast. So the true balance of that may end up being a couple billion lower in FY23 and 24 after investment activity is factored in. But that's not a true budget reserve because it's the source of the POMV draw that's our largest source of revenue.
So is that $10,900,000,000 available for us to take action on in a fairly efficient way with 21 and 11 votes, or is there complications with assets they hold and other calls on that, on those funds?
Mr. Chairman, it is available to appropriate. However, if you spent a significant amount, the fund has some amount of cash holdings, but if you go much beyond that amount, you would force them to sell some assets to create those amounts. So even though those are realized gains, the entire fund is invested together. So some of those assets may be holding public equities, private equities, real estate, and so forth. So liquidating a large amount may reduce the amount truly available to the legislature. If you go into having to liquidate illiquid assets like private equity or real estate.
Okay. I think we had Senator Hoffman. And then Senator Bishop, did you have your hand up? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, you had stated that in the CBR balance of FY23, there was not the sufficient votes to access that account. Therefore, no funds were spent. I would say that for FY24, the numbers to get three-quarters vote are even harder to come by. So I don't envision the legislature accessing the CBR unless there's something that miraculous happens. And I don't think that the members of this finance committee believe that there's going to be a three-quarter vote by the legislature this coming year. The other question that I have is on line 19, you talked about the other transfers, the $7.8 million. You referenced the transfer from the Renewable Energy Fund. Can you expound upon that, please?
Through the Chair, Senator Hoffman. So, yes, $7.5 million of that figure in FY24 is the transfer from the General Fund to the Renewable Energy Fund. And then in the capital budget, there's a $7.5 million appropriation from the Renewable Energy Fund to the Alaska Energy Authority for those projects. The money gets into that fund in that case by this UGF transfer. So sort of is turning UGF into DGF in terms of how it's spent, but it ends up impacting the deficit in the same way as if you just spent the UGF.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We all realize this is the governor's budget and we still haven't had our crack at it, and we've got a lot of needs out there: community assistance, deferred maintenance for schools, university deferred maintenance, and other things. So depending upon how we address the governor's budget, the deficit could be maybe even more by the time we leave.
So can you help the committee? Is there funds in there for the university's normal request for $50 million for deferred maintenance?
Mr. Chairman, there's not a amount specific to the deferred maintenance in the university. There are some other university projects, but not that deferred maintenance amount.
And then is there funds to replenish community assistance going forward?
Mr. Chairman, there is not. So the statutory appropriation to that would be $30 million from the general fund, and that is not part of the governor's budget.
I think those two items add to $50 million. They're significant. The committee will decide collectively later on what they want to do, if anything, with those two items. But they're two big items that we look at every budget cycle. Could you maybe help us a little bit more on Mustang Road? We've had some challenges with that initial project going back maybe a decade or so, maybe a little longer now. I can't remember that we had some audits and some follow-up audits, and we've been working with the department trying to clean up that project. So can you help us with that? And the reason I'm asking that might be a subject that the committee might want to take a look at in retrospect to put the current request into context.
Mr. Chairman, that change was new to us in the amended budget. We asked for some clarification from the department, and they explained what they did, but we don't really have a whole lot of information about why that decision was made and who made the decision to transfer assets rather than cash. We can look into that and get back to the committee with more information.
That would be helpful. I think we might need to have a special hearing on that subject matter because of the complexity and of that and the history. Some of the members probably weren't here maybe when the initial transaction took place, and then the cleanup afterwards. So we can work. We'll have you help the committee with some information, and we'll get with our auditors and we'll figure out when we want to put that on the table. But I think we should be tuned up on that to understand that issue, and if there's problems with it, how to continually clean it up to get it behind us. Does the presentation today take into account the fast track supplemental requests that are going to come down at us? Because you're showing here we're post-transfer surplus or deficit, we're already underwater, or pretty much at water level. I think yesterday's OMB number showed us just a smidgen above, and you're showing us a smidgen under. So can you help us with that? And then if it's not the case that it's not in these numerics, do you have any comments on how we could fund that?
Mr. Chairman, the fast track items were all included in the governor's regular supplementals, so it's sort of a duplication. So we're not counting them again here, but they are included in these totals. So the fast track bill essentially is just pulling those three items out of the regular bill and putting them in their own bill. So it would not add to the appropriations in FY23 if they're then removed from the other bill.
Okay. We'll probably need some assistance from Ledge Finance and how to fund those items without having a fast track appropriation bill, because there's some concern that we won't see it through the other body, or it might look totally different. So we need to work on that to try to facilitate those needs that the governor has pointed out that need to be addressed ASAP. In other words, before July 1. So if you could do that work and then get back to our crew and we'll figure that out. We'll go to Senator Keel and Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, as the chairman was talking about big ticket items that aren't reflected here, can you talk about the relationship between that K-12 forward funding line and any decision the legislature makes this year on increasing the K-12 school funding for FY24?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So with no forward funding available, essentially the appropriation in the governor's budget just covers FY24, the FY24 formula as it's currently written. If the body chooses to increase the base student allocation through a statute, then the appropriation would still pick that up, but there would need to be additional funds essentially. So there wouldn't be forward funding available that could be used to pay for that increase. It would have to come from an increase to that appropriation. The same if there's outside the formula money, that would need a new appropriation on top of what's in the governor's budget today.
Thank you.
So we're, to put it in context, we're $500 million underwater today. If the committee supports the standard request from the university for deferred maintenance and municipal assistance. It's just assumptions. They guys may not. We'll work that out as we go down the process, but that would put us at about $500 million underwater before any education change are additions to capital needs of the state or other expenditure issues that may hit the table. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the audience that's watching, can you give us on line 13 the $1,600,000,000 figure and how that translates into annual dividend per individual, and the same for the governor's budget for FY24, the $2,470,000,000, what that would translate into individual dividend.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. So last year's dividend included two parts. There was the dividend itself and then an energy relief payment. While they were functionally very similar, the IRS is agreeing that they are two different payments for tax purposes. So the energy relief payment is not subject to federal income tax, and the regular one is. So the total dividend between the two was $3,284. $662 of that was from the energy relief. That shows up in the statewide items as $420 million. The remaining amount, and I'm going to bungle the math if I try to do it in my head, but is roughly $2,600, was that PFD itself, the actual 50% of percent of market value PFD that went in. The 2.47 estimate in FY24 would pay about $3,800 per person. And in a few slides, we'll talk about the sensitivity of that estimate, whether that's really kind of the right number to use or not.
I didn't pick up the numeric on the dividend.
Mr. Chairman, it would be about $3,800 per person in FY24.
$3,800.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
That's fine. I just wanted that on the record so that the audience can have some comparison to what the legislature accomplished in dividends in 23 as compared to what the governor is proposing in 24.
Thank you. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be have it just a benefit to Alaskans if we just split out the dividend and just call it an energy rebate?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'm not a tax attorney, so I do not want to try to speculate about how the IRS would treat that. I think we were surprised that the IRS treated the energy rebate differently than, or energy relief payment differently than the dividend, but I'm not sure if they plan that to go forward or not, but that'd be something to explore with legislative legal. Sure.
Any other questions on this page? Okay, we'll go on to page number 8.
This next slide shows oil price volatility since 2020. So we like to show this after we show the very precise numbers on the fiscal summary to remind you that things change. So in the last 3 years, we've seen, or I guess four years, we've seen oil go from negative at one point to $125 a barrel, and then has been hanging out in the upper 70s through low 80s in the past few months. I think there you can get a little complacent when we have a couple of months like this, where oil seems to be bounded, and think that it will remain bounded. But you know, as this history shows, that you can find all sorts of little periods in here of bounded oil, and then things change. So, as much as we can think that we may know what's going to happen, it's very hard to predict oil at a longer scale. And the important thing to recognize here, as we go into the next slide, is going to be that the price of oil has a very strong effect on our revenue. So the current at current prices, the sensitivity is about $70 million of revenue for every dollar change in the price per barrel of oil over the course of a year. So, you know, if you look back at that last slide, you can see that oil has gone in the last year from over $100 a barrel to the 70s, and you know, those swings are hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars for the state of Alaska if those sustain. And so when we're looking at these very precise figures of the governor's budget, you know, has $200,000 from balancing in FY23, just keep in mind how quickly that can change and how much kind of margin of error there is on that forecast. So in FY23, The forecast is for $88.45 per barrel. That's almost exactly the break-even price for the year, or the break-even price after all fund transfers. Before fund transfers, that larger deficit would be, the break-even price would be $95 a barrel. So to truly balance our budget on an ongoing basis in FY23, we'd be $95 a barrel oil. After we've transferred from savings, that goes down to just about that revenue forecast of $88.45. Go on to slide 10. So as of Friday, oil prices for the fiscal year have averaged $91.72. They would need to average about $82.70 to match the forecast. So that's pretty good. The price on Friday dipped down a little bit to $79.85, so a little bit under. And I think this illustrates the difficulty in oil, trying to get the oil price forecast correct. The Department of Revenue's fall forecast has proven to be pretty accurate so far because oil has been in that bounded range. It's still, right now, if you carry that $79.85, to the end of the year, you'd end up, about a dollar off. That's really good. That's a really good forecast. That's $70 million that's not funded in our budget. So, we have that post-transfer deficit of, less than $1 million. There's budget language in FY23 that fills the deficit from the statutory budget reserve that has about $20 million in it. So we have about $20 million of wiggle room, and beyond that, we have an unfunded budget. So if oil ends up truly a dollar below the forecast, then we would have a $50 million hole in our FY23 budget, because there's currently no source for deficits beyond the statutory budget reserve. We do not have CBR access because that vote was not agreed to, and the SBR balance was reduced as a result of vetoes by the governor of transfers that would have gone into that account. Even if oil prices and production did exactly match the forecast, there's a bit of a margin of error in revenue forecasting. The true revenue we receive is based on payments, not necessarily based on liabilities. So even if we absolutely nail everything, there's still some margin of error because of individual company activity and things that we don't anticipate. So it's very much within the realm of possibility that we could completely nail price and production and still end up $20 million off, leaving an unfunded budget. So if the legislature does adopt the governor's supplemental budget as it exists, the Legislative Finance Division would strongly recommend designating a source for deficits beyond the SBR balance. Having $20 million of headroom is just not sufficient to be safe and avoid an unfunded budget at the end of the year after the legislature has adjourned for the year. We will get the spring forecast sometime next month that will help us refine that FY23 figure, but really that FY23 revenue figure won't be known until the end of the year. So having some margin of error by either reducing FY23 appropriations or finding another source for that deficit would give you a lot more comfort and breathing room in case things do not exactly match the forecast, which they would be required to under the current budget proposed by the governor.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At a prior meeting, we were talking about the vacancy factor, and there's a substantial difference for this current fiscal year of what was budgeted and what the actuals were. But as I recall, that was larger than the $50 million that we're discussing. Do you remember that number?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I think the amount lapsed in FY22 from personal services was something in the $70 to $80 million range. I don't remember the exact number, but it was somewhere in that range last year. Looking at the high vacancy rate today, one thing I would note is that some of the agencies with the highest vacancy rates are actually asking for supplementals this year. And so those are the Department of Corrections and Public Safety, among others. Part of the reason that they're asking for supplementals despite having vacancies is that when these agencies have vacancies, they have to fill those activities. They can't just close the prison because they don't have enough guards. They have to pay overtime. that actually costs more than having an employee. And so similarly, there are several supplementals for the public defender agency. There's some vacancies there. You could say, oh, they have extra money. They have vacancies. They have to contract that out because the cases continue, and that costs more than having state employees. So while there is sometimes lapse, and there was in FY22, often when we look at it agency by agency, the vacancies result in higher costs and positive supplementals because of that. But there may be some agencies that will lapse and that will lapse some funds. If that's available, that may help our situation. But I'm not aware of any large anticipated lapses at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So if we go down this course of action, well, let me back up a little bit for the for those watching at home. The committee, this table last year, decided that we were going to increase the size of this statutory budget reserve. And in doing so, we moved money into that so it wouldn't end up in the CBR, Constitutional Budget Reserve, with some maneuvering at the end, in case we had a shortfall in revenue. On the upside, in case we had excess revenue, we had the forward funding of education and then money into the other mechanisms after that. And that was, above basically $1.2 billion surplus. So we took the view that our financial fortunes could go either direction, up or down. We're a little dismayed, I guess, that it's on the downside versus the upside, as we sit here today. So we're looking at between now and June, or basically the month of June. And as Senator Hoffman said, it's unlikely that there would be support for a CBR vote in this building. So what happens, or what should we expect if we ran short of $100 million, $50 million, or $200 million in June at the end of the fiscal year? Do we trigger the impoundment clause? Do we shut the state down? Does the world end? What's the ramifications?
Mr. Chairman, so if we ended the year, if we adjourned for the year and we had an unbalanced budget in FY23, that could trigger the impoundment clause, which essentially allows the governor to restrict appropriations. There are some that would be probably easier to restrict than others. I don't know if we want to talk about that too much in the committee, but the largest one would be in the appropriation of the Port of Anchorage. $75 million of that was appropriated using FY23 funds, but not available until FY24 to the grantee. So simply restricting that and showing that that's not available in FY24 would have the effect of, reducing the budget in FY23. However, that appropriation came out of the SBR, so then that would create a shortfall in the SBR if that funding was used elsewhere. So the governor could try to use that to reduce FY23 appropriations, but then that would create a hole elsewhere. Other items, the governor would, I think, be in a very difficult position at the end of the year of having to, if he had an unbalanced budget, he could veto supplemental appropriations. He could restrict other spending as needed. There would not be particularly great options on the table, depending on the size of the gap at the end of the year.
So let me try to refine my question a little bit. If we give them, we'll deliver the budgets at some point, in May. Hopefully we'll wrap up on time, less than 121 days. We give him the budget, he signs them. We don't know if we're going to have enough money. It's so tight for the month of June, and we won't be here. So do we have to estimate the cash flow at the very end of session to deal with this, or do we just go home and find out if he can make payroll the last 2 weeks in June?
Mr. Chairman, historically what the legislature has done in this situation is designate a reserve balance to cover any shortfall. So an example would be the FY15 I guess, yeah, the FY15 budget, after prices had gone down, the legislature designated the higher education fund as the sort of fund of last resort beyond the SVR balance. It turned out not to be needed for that purpose, but the legislature essentially that year said, you know, if you run short on money, this is the next place you can go. So we created sort of a cascading set of places that the governor could draw from. That's one way you could structure things. The governor could also call the legislature back in a special session and request further appropriations. You know, just because the fiscal year ends on June 30th, the books for FY23 will be open through August, because that's the, as it's called, the reappropriation period when agencies are finalizing their budgets. There could still be changes made to the budget during that time that could influence the ending situation FY23. So the governor could just call the legislature back to deal with any hole during that period.
So you're talking about him calling us back. Technically, he could do that in July in the FY24 fiscal year to fix the FY23 fiscal year budget that's already behind us in the calendar, but not technically in the bookwork.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And then change things with a retroactive effective date. That would be possible, although obviously it's not ideal to be doing it retroactively. That has been done. We have given agencies supplementals retroactively to the previous fiscal year.
Okay. I'll volunteer up to Port of Anchorage. Senator Merritt.
Port of Alaska.
Port of Alaska.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Thank you, Mr. Painter. Can you just give me a brief history of the three-quarter CBR vote, and if the failure to achieve that number is a recent phenomenon, or is that something that's happened, you know, throughout the legislative history?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick. So generally, we've had CBR liabilities starting in the 1990s, going through 2010. In years that required a CBR vote, I think most of those years required it because there were deficits through 2010. There was one year when the legislature did not agree on a CBR vote by the end of the session, special sessions. That was 2004. The legislature went back and approved the reverse sweep that year in the supplemental, the next session. That's the only case before the last few years where the legislature sort of left town without a constitutional budget reserve vote when it's been required. We had fully paid off the CBR for a few years in the 2010s before reopening that liability. Since then, we agreed to CBR votes from FY15 through FY20, I suppose. I think it was the FY21 and 22 votes that failed and were not adopted at any point.
Thank you.
Any other questions on this page? Going to page 11.
Slide 11, moving on to FY24, shows the fiscal sensitivity for FY24. So the DOR forecast is for $81 a barrel. That would correspond to that $434 million deficit we saw on the fiscal summary. The break-even price for the governor's budget would be $87 per barrel, based on all of the governor's amended budget.
And just as a reminder, I think the oil and gas industry uses a the financing firms, from my understanding, within that economic area, use a $60 price range. They want to see the industry profitable at $60 for financing their development. So that's quite a spread, $60 to $87. So we need to be cognizant of that as we move substantially away from that break-even point of $60 a barrel. And I'm not implying that we can get to $60 a barrel. I'm just saying the further north we go from that, the dicier it gets for us.
Going on to slide 12. So again, the governor's budget has a pre-transfer deficit of $434 million. One of the items that influences that is the statutory PFD estimate of $2,470.9 million. So the statutory permanent fund dividend is based on a five-year average of statutory net income ending in the previous fiscal year to when the dividend is paid. So this dividend that goes out in FY24, the last year of the average is our current year, FY23. And so in that estimated $2.47 billion is a $4.6 billion estimate for statutory net income in FY23. However, through December, statutory net income of the permanent fund was significantly below that. It was at $1 billion, which would be a pace for $2 billion for the year. So if that trend continues, the projected statutory PFD would not be $2.47 billion. It would be $2.196 billion. That would have the effect of reducing the FY23 deficit from $434 million to $160 million. It would also decrease the projected payment from $3,800 per recipient to $3,400 per recipient. But that number will not be known until the end of the fiscal year. So the estimate, the official estimate, is going to remain that $2.5 billion amount. But just to be on the, so the committee is aware, the, I don't want to call it the upside, but from our deficit standpoint, the upside, the downside to the recipients and to the balance of the ERA is that that would reduce the statutory dividend and lead to a smaller deficit. So with no forward funding available after the supplementals, the deficit in the governor's budget is made up from that revenue replacement, the remaining statutory budget reserve balance after whatever is used in FY23, and then the constitutional budget reserve.
Do we have any, I think this is the last slide. Do we have any questions or comments on the presentation before we start our robust budget process here the next couple months? Okay, well, we've heard it here. We're 450 to 500 million underwater before we make adjustments. So something's got to give if we want to be home and see the 4th of July parade in person. So I'd like to, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, do you have any idea what you talked about Minnesota to start off with and some of the questions that were related to that? Do you have other stuff, what other states do when they are fixed? Or are facing half $1 billion worth of deficits, and they're on and have a volatile revenue stream for the state system.
Through the chair, Senator Olson. So, you know, Alaska, as I said, has probably the most volatile revenue of any state. Other states that do have revenue volatility will rely on reserves or reduce spending or increase taxes. Those are generally the levers available. Mm-hmm. You know, in North Dakota a few years ago, there was discussion about using their permanent fund on in a rate higher than perhaps the sustainable percentage to try to meet a short-term deficit. But I'm not sure. I have not been following what the other oil-producing states are dealing with in terms of their current budget. Generally, sales tax collections and income tax collections nationally have been higher than projections. So most states currently are in pretty rosy financial circumstances, although I would guess that some of the other resource extraction states may be facing deficit issues like Alaska.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any other final questions? Okay. Well, the good news of the day is there's no meeting tomorrow.
No meeting.
Okay. But Thursday, 9 a.m., we're going to have a presentation that we've been waiting for, dealing with the public employees retirement system and the teachers retirement system, better known as PERS and TERS. What we've asked the Department of Retirement or the Division of Retirement and Benefits to do is give us an update on the newer tiers, the ones that have been out about 17 years now in place or so, 16 or so, what their status is relative to the tiers that replace the defined benefit, final defined benefit tiers were replaced with the defined contribution plan. And we're going to do a checkup. And I think we'll find that complicated. We'll find it interesting. And it's going to further some, I'm sure, some continued discussion, because no matter what side of the of the issue folks are on, they're going to have questions. So we'll have those comparisons looking at the status of the account balances, basically, not of individual persons, but as groups, because we don't deal with individuals. We'll also have some discussion on the supplemental benefit system and how that works and the status of that and what folks are not included in Social Security or supplemental benefit system, and which ones are. We've asked them to give us a breakdown statewide, including municipalities. As an example, some firemen we'll find is most likely not in SPS or Social Security, and some maybe. And there'll be other entities, hospitals, and other things. So we're going to take that up at 9 a.m. And then I've also asked Ledge Finance to take a look at retention issues. They've been working on that, turnover. And we'll have that sometime after this presentation. And we'll also have I'll have some more discussion with the Division of Retirement Benefits on some other areas as we dig into the information and comparative analysis of the tier systems. So in the event that we identify issues, problems, or challenges, then we could have the next set of conversations on how to repair it, fix it, adjust it, replace it, whatever, as we work through the analysis. So I think hopefully everybody will be here 9 a.m. Thursday, and we're going to delve into this subject that's going to get fairly complex fairly quick. So we'll see everybody at 9 a.m. Thursday morning. We are adjourned.